Ainsley. She is summoned to her grandmother's house after she gets home from work. Getting to the boutique and seeing Kaylee that morning had been a relief. It felt like she had been away forever. Something had happened with Harper, although Ainsley wasn't sure what. She had been fine after seeing Mrs. Donegal, but when Harper picked up Ainsley in Vineyard Haven, she was trembling, teary, weird. Adults remain a mystery to Ainsley. Harper's mood improved when they got back to Nantucket, even once they learned that Eleanor was in residence at Seamless. "I should probably go say hello," Harper said when they saw the note from Aunt Flossie on the kitchen counter. "I haven't seen Flossie in eons."
"Me either," Ainsley said.
She had last seen Aunt Flossie on spring break in Florida when she was in sixth grade. Flossie was a younger, much more fun version of her grandmother.
"But can we wait until morning?"
Ainsley wasn't quite ready for things to go back to the way they'd been.
"Grammy is probably asleep anyway."
It was 9:30 at night.
"You're right," Harper said. "Let's wait until morning."
Harper had headed over to Seamless the next morning, but Ainsley had to get to work at the boutique. She thought perhaps she had dodged a bullet at least for another day, but as soon as she gets home, Harper says, "Your grandmother would like to see you."
"Oh," Ainsley says, "are you coming too?"
"No," Harper says, "she wants to speak to you alone."
Ainsley dreads the mandatory solo audience with her grandmother. She expects a lecture. Even the sound of the doorbell when Ainsley rings it. She and Tabitha are required to ring the bell when Eleanor is in residence so they don't catch her indisposed. Sounds ominous. Philippa answers. Ainsley hasn't seen Philippa in weeks, but there is no cheerful reunion. Philippa nods at Ainsley as though she's the exterminator.
"Señorita?"
"Hey, Flippa," Ainsley says. "Qué pasa?"
Philippa leads Ainsley to the glassed-in porch, where her grandmother is sitting on the divan, wearing a silk kimono, black with white lilies. There's a cane hooked over the arm of the divan. Eleanor's hair is more white than silver now. She looks about 100 years old.
"Hi, Grammy," Ainsley says.
She senses that her grandmother can't stand up to greet her, so she bends over to kiss Eleanor's powdered cheek. She smells evening in Paris. She wonders if Grammy has heard about the pilfered Bombay Sapphire and her in-school suspension, but the girl Ainsley was back then isn't the girl Ainsley is now. Eleanor pats the divan.
"Sit, sweetie," she says. "I've missed you."
Ainsley sits. The view over Nantucket Sound is pretty, and Ainsley tries to relax. Her grandmother doesn't sound at all angry, but then why the formal summons?
"Where's Aunt Flossie?" Ainsley asks.
"She's out for the night," Eleanor says. "She has a date with Chet, my taxi driver."
"She does?" Ainsley says. "I thought she was married."
"She is," Eleanor says. "Her husband is 85 years old, however. She wanted to enjoy the company of a younger man tonight. It's perfectly harmless, I assure you. Besides, I needed Flossie out of the house. We're having an intervention."
Suddenly, Ainsley wants to puke. An intervention? She hasn't had a drink all summer, hasn't smoked any dope, not one cigarette. Doesn't her grandmother know this? Ainsley needs to explain. Just when things are finally straightening out for her, she's getting shipped off to rehab? Well, she won't go. She won't.
"Grammy, I don't think an intervention is necessary."
"But it is," Eleanor says. "I've let this feud between your mother and your aunt go on for too long. I should have set things straight 14 years ago.
"What?"
Ainsley says. "Julian's death was my fault," Eleanor says. "I'm the one your mother should be blaming, not your aunt."
"What?"
Ainsley says.
She has never once heard her grandmother speak Julian's name. But the shock of this is overridden by her relief that the intervention is not meant for her. Eleanor says,
"I want you to know, my darling, that there are many things in my life I regret. I have made horrible mistakes.
I've treated the people I love most in abominable ways. Billy, for one. I loved him, but I shat all over the man. At some point, I decided I had outgrown him, or that he had never been good enough for me in the first place. That wasn't true, of course. Your grandfather was the most handsome, gracious man in the city of Boston. But I made him feel small. I insulted him, I called him names, I drove him away. He hated me for years. And your mother. I can't even begin to enumerate my transgressions against your mother. Eleanor's voice wavers, and Ainsley shifts uncomfortably. On the cigar table next to the divan, her grandmother has a drink, probably her usual Mount Gay and tonic. She brings the glass to her mouth, but her hand is shaking. Grammy, Ainsley says. She would like to say something comforting to Eleanor, but what can one say to a 71-year-old woman that won't sound patronizing? Her grandmother has been awful to the people closest to her. She's a battle axe, a dragon lady. She prefers that people fear her rather than love her. And yet Ainsley is impressed that her grandmother has reached this moment of self-awareness. Probably it's a result of breaking her hip. Ainsley supposes that being so incapacitated is humbling and painful and reminds one of one's own mortality. Ainsley is saved from having to speak because a second later the doorbell rings and shortly thereafter Harper walks in. She smiles sympathetically at Ainsley. Did Mommy fill you in then? Kind of, Ainsley says, but not really. Eleanor brought up Julian but never finished the thought. There is no time to pursue this idea because the doorbell rings again and Ainsley thinks, FedEx? Or Flossie? Would Eleanor make Flossie use the doorbell while she was staying here? Quite possibly. What's the big emergency? A voice says. Ainsley's head swivels. Her mother walks onto the porch. Sit down, Tabitha, Eleanor says. Tabitha takes a head count. She stares hard at Harper, then her eyes rest on Ainsley, and there's a glimmer of a smile. Hello, darling, she says. She holds out her arms, and Ainsley can't help herself. She rushes into them. It's her mother. Mama, Ainsley says. Tabitha squeezes her, kisses the top of her head. Ainsley inhales, hoping for the familiar mom scent, but her mother smells like she has been living with a litter of feral cats at the bottom of a laundry hamper. I need you girls to sit, Eleanor says. Ainsley reclaims her place on the divan. Harper perches on the arm of an overstuffed chair, and Tabitha dutifully sinks into the matching chair. Ainsley looks back and forth between her mother and her aunt. After spending so much time with Harper, Ainsley thought she would be able to easily distinguish between the two, but they are eerily identical. If Ainsley closed her eyes, and they switched places or didn't, changed clothes or didn't, would she be able to tell them apart? What is it, Mother? Tabitha says. She wants to broker a peace treaty, Harper says. I'll help her out. I'm sorry, Tabitha. I'm sorry for everything. I'm sorry about the party at the boutique. I'm sorry I hired Kaylee, and I'm sorry about Julian. Julian, Tabitha says. She casts an eye at Ainsley. We aren't talking about this in front of my daughter. We most certainly are, Eleanor says. Ainsley is more than old enough to know what happened. Eleanor lifts her drink to her lips, then slowly, carefully sets her glass down. She looks at Ainsley. Your brother was born prematurely. It's a miracle he lived at all, frankly. But his lungs never caught up to the rest of him. Ainsley nods. This much she knows, or thinks she knows. She can count on one hand the number of times Julian's name has come up in conversation, but his ghost is always hovering around, haunting them. His death is the foundation of her mother's personality, her sorrow, her impatience, her indifference. Please stop, Mother, Tabitha says softly. Your mother blames your aunt for Julian's death, Eleanor says without taking her eyes off Ainsley, That's why they didn't speak for so many years.
Blames her why? Ainsley says. If he just stopped breathing?
She, Tabitha says. I, Harper says. Your aunt came to Nantucket to help, Eleanor says. And on her last night here, she persuaded your mother to go out to dinner, to go out dancing. And that was the night that Julian died.
I wasn't home, Tabitha says. If I had been home, it wouldn't have happened.
Nonsense, Eleanor says.
That is complete nonsense, Tabitha Frost, and you know it.
Eleanor's voice is louder and sharper than Ainsley has ever heard it. Eleanor's anger is usually expressed by her choice of words, not by the volume at which she speaks them.
Your father and I could never figure it out, Eleanor says. We used to puzzle over it. What had happened? Why the discord?
Billy thought one thing, I thought another.
I'm afraid to ask, Harper says.
That was between Billy and me, and I'm certainly not going to share our private conversations with you now, Eleanor says. I brought you here so I could apologize. I need to say I'm sorry.
For what, Mother? Tabitha says.
I blame myself for Julian's death, Eleanor says. First off, I should have insisted on paying for a longer stay in the hospital.
Wyatt would never have accepted your charity, Tabitha says.
Will you please let me finish? Eleanor says. They're all quiet, and Eleanor takes the opportunity to enjoy a dramatic pause. She takes a prolonged sip of her drink. They all watch as her hands tremble, and the ice does a nervous dance in the glass.
We opened the boutique at the Candle Street location that summer, Eleanor says. Remember?
Yes, Tabitha says.
I was desperate to have it ready for Memorial Day weekend, Eleanor says. And we had that unseasonably warm weather.
She looks at Tabitha, and her eyes brim with tears.
I worked you to the bone. There you were, 6.5 months pregnant, and I was asking you to carry boxes and move racks of dresses down sidewalks and up and down curbs in the sweltering sun. I barely let you sit down. And when you did, do you remember what I gave you to drink? Do you remember, Tabitha?
An espresso, Tabitha says.
I gave you espresso, Eleanor says. I thought it would pep you up.
She shakes her head, and one tear drops.
I had such a trial carrying the two of you that as far as I was concerned, being pregnant with one baby was no big deal. Part of me, I'm sure, thought you were getting off easy.
Eleanor stares at her hands in her lap.
I was monstrous. You started complaining of pains, and the next thing I knew, you were in full-blown labor at 28 weeks.
She takes another sip of her drink.
I'm responsible for Julian's premature birth, and therefore I'm responsible for his dying. Why you've been blaming your sister is beyond me.
Everyone is quiet for a while, processing Eleanor's confession. Ainsley is in awe of the many ways that parents are able to screw up their children's lives. She had thought she was nearly out of Tabitha's grip. In a couple of years, she will be 18, an adult. But now she realizes a mother's rule can last one's entire life.
I'm confused about this so-called puzzling you and Daddy used to do, Harper says. These private conversations.
You and Daddy never even spoke, did you?
Don't change the subject, Tabitha says.
She turns on Eleanor.
You're only taking the blame now to protect Harper.
At that moment, Eleanor drops her glass. It glances off the edge of the cigar table, hits the floor, and shatters. There are glass shards and ice everywhere. The drink splashes all over the Tabriz rug and the bottom of Eleanor's kimono. But Eleanor barely bats an eye, making Ainsley think her grandmother dropped it on purpose.
Just let it be my fault, Eleanor says. I want the two of you to kiss and make up. I want you to do what siblings are supposed to do. Hate your parents, but love each other. Flossie and I both despised my mother. Even now, 60 years later, we talk about how awful she was. I don't know what I would have done if I didn't have Flossie to commiserate with. She's my sister. But you, Tabitha Winfred Frost, and you, Harper Vivian Frost, are more than sisters. Ainsley scoots over so she can take her grandmother's hand.
You heard Grammy, Ainsley says to her mother and her aunt. Since we're talking about Julian, we might as well acknowledge that I lost him too. I saw the pictures of him that you hid in the bookshelves. I was never allowed to claim him or mourn him. All my friends think I was always an only child. But you two have each other. You're so lucky.
Ainsley turns her gaze to her mother.
Please, Mama, forgive Aunt Harper. For me?
It was never just Julian, Tabitha says.
I've been angry since Harper left with Billy. She won, and I hated her for it.
Won? Eleanor says. I would hardly describe going with Billy as winning.
Or am I dreadfully mistaken?
She looks up at Tabitha.
I always figured you came to your senses and decided you would be happier with me.
The point is, Mother, we shouldn't have had to choose, Tabitha says.
It was cruel of you, and of Daddy too, for agreeing to it, breaking the two of us apart like that. We were inseparable, you knew that, but you thought nothing of snipping us apart like we were paper dolls. One minute we were a duo, a team, a party of two, and the next minute I'd lost the game, and Harper was leaving.
What game? Eleanor says. We shot rock, paper, scissors, Harper says. The winner got to go with Billy.
Oh, for heaven's sake, Eleanor says.
What's rock, paper, scissors? Ainsley asks. It sounds like something an early English settler would play.
It's a game Billy taught the twins because that's how he and his schoolyard chums used to settle disputes at Boston Latin.
Eleanor looks into her lap.
The winner got to go with Billy.
The winner?
And the loser had to stay with me. Was I really that bad?
Tears shine in Eleanor's eyes, and Ainsley feels a lump presenting in her throat.
Her poor grandmother. She built a career, she made money, she owns houses and fancy things. But she had not been the girl's favorite.
Ainsley knows how she feels. She's an only child, but there have been plenty of times recently when she has felt like nobody's favorite.
We were kids, Mother, Tabitha says. We were sheltered 17-year-old girls.
I suppose your father would have been far more appealing, Eleanor says. Billy Frost was as charming as the devil himself. Women of all ages loved him. And you two girls, well, you both adored him blindly. You always fought to be the one he carried around on his shoulders.
Both of you daddy's girls, through and through. Just like Flossie and me.
She turns to Ainsley. Be warned, darling. You come from a long line of strong, disagreeable women.
Tabitha says, Harper asked a valid question, Mother.
When did you and Daddy have these chats about us? You never called him, and when he came to Nantucket, you refused to see him.
Eleanor wipes her eyes and laughs.
That shows how little you pay attention. Billy came over every night of his stay, after you were asleep.
He did? Tabitha says.
And you...
what?
What do you think? Eleanor says.
Like I told you, I loved Billy Frost with all my heart. I was never able to resist him.
Nor was he able to resist me, I suppose.
A smile crosses her face, and she sits up a little straighter in her chair.
I would like you girls to give each other a hug, a real hug. And then I'd like you both to clean up this mess I've made.
Ainsley knows her mother and aunt are nearly 40, too old to be ordered around, but they comply with Eleanor's wishes. Harper holds out her arms and, incredibly, Ainsley watches her mother take a step toward her. Soon they're embracing. It's surreal to see two people so alike clinging to each other that way. Ainsley imagines them 4 decades earlier, floating side by side in the womb. They have been together since the moment of conception. It's a miraculous thing, when she thinks about it. When they separate, Tabitha bends down to pick up the shards of glass, and Harper cups her hand to accept them. Ainsley, figuring she'd better not just sit around like a lapdog, hurries into the kitchen for a sponge and a towel.
She tries to imagine herself explaining what transpired here today to Kaylee.
My grandmother took responsibility for my brother's premature birth. My mother and aunt played a game with rocks, paper, and scissors that determined their futures. My grandmother confessed that she had been secretly rendezvousing with my grandfather for all these years, even though they're both really old.
She sees Kaylee's smile. And why not? Despite the drama, when Ainsley bends to mop up the sticky mess of rum and tonic, she feels good. It'll probably only last a couple of minutes. But for now, she's going to enjoy being part of a happy family. Or if not a happy family, then at least a family without any secrets. No sooner has Ainsley formulated this thought than Harper clears her throat. I'm pregnant, she says. Tabitha. This summer, she and Harper have agreed on very little, but they both agree, once they are out of Seamless and back in the carriage house, that it's time for Harper to return to the vineyard for good. Tabitha will go back with her, but only for a day or two. She needs to pack up her things and settle up with the subcontractors. She needs to write up a punch list of things for Harper to take care of before they put Billy's house on the market.
So you're both going to the vineyard? Ainsley says. You're going together?
In Harper's car, Tabitha says. And I'm bringing our car back. She feels heinously guilty leaving her daughter again, but she has to tie up loose ends.
Franklin, she thinks. She will try to find Franklin to say goodbye. She owes him that. She owes herself that.
Eleanor isn't happy that Tabitha and Harper are leaving, but she has Flossie for one more day, and she has Ainsley. Besides, she was the one who orchestrated the reunion. She really has no right to complain. As the ferry pulls into Oak Bluffs, Harper and Tabitha sit side by side in the front seat of Harper's Bronco, and Fish is asleep in the back.
Are you nervous? Tabitha asks her sister.
She told Harper that she had gone to see Reed. She admitted that it had been her plan to pull a secret twister and seduce the doctor under false pretenses, but she hadn't been able to go through with it. She also told Harper how in love Reed had seemed with the person he believed to be Harper. She then gave Harper the address.
You need to go see him, she said, especially now.
Nervous doesn't begin to cover it, Harper says. How about you?
Why would I be nervous? Tabitha asks.
Harper shrugs. A little while later, she says, Was it real between you and Franklin? I mean, it happened really fast.
Harper, Tabitha says, It was real.
They don't say much on the ride to the house. Tabitha has been gone less than a full day, but she's relieved to be back on the same island as Franklin. She wants so badly to believe that he'll come to his senses and live his life for himself. She and Harper walk in the back door of Billy's house into the kitchen. Tad is on his hands and knees in front of the refrigerator. He's putting in the last of the new floorboards. When he looks up, his eyes dart back and forth between the twins. Whoa, he says.
Hi, Tad, Harper says. Freaked out by the twin thing?
Tabitha doesn't care if he is or isn't.
Is Franklin here?
She asks.
Have you seen him?
Tad gets to his feet and wipes his hands off on his Carhartts.
He was here earlier today, actually.
Tabitha's heart feels like a bird smacking against a window.
He was?
He was. He asked for you. I told him you left.
You told him? Did you tell him where I went?
I didn't know where you went, Tad said. You bolted out of here without a word. He could see, obviously, that you'd left your car behind.
So then what happened?
Then he left, Tad says.
How long ago was that? Tabitha asks.
Hours ago, Tad says. And no, he didn't tell me where he was going or when he'd be back.
He turns his attention to Harper.
How have you been? He asks.
I wouldn't know where to begin, Harper says.
Harper.
She has a harder time leaving Nantucket than she thought she would. It doesn't take her long to pack, and with 1 hour in town, she's able to say her goodbyes. At the boutique, she hugged Megan and gave baby David Wayne a kiss on the forehead. Then she held out her arms to Kaylee.
Thank you,
she whispered. You saved the store.
Don't be dramatic, Kaylee said.
Tabitha was angry when she found out you were working at the store, Harper said. But even she can't argue with a 500% increase in sales.
Is she going to let me stay? Kaylee asked.
Absolutely, Harper said. I bet you'll even grow to like her.
You think?
Kaylee said.
But not as much as you like me, of course, Harper said.
Harper walked up Main Street to the offices of Stryker and McLean. The receptionist, Bonnie, narrowed her eyes at Harper.
Which one are you? She asked.
Harper,
Harper said.
I only ask because I heard Tabitha is coming back, Bonnie said.
Wow, Harper thought. Nantucket gossip moves even faster than Vineyard gossip. That must be because it has a shorter distance to travel and less traffic to deal with.
That's right, Harper said.
At that moment, Ramsey appeared to save her.
If you're leaving, then I assume your sister is coming back, Ramsey said.
She is, Harper said. She considered informing Ramsey that Tabitha had fallen in love over on the other island, but she bit her tongue. For all she knew, Tabitha was planning to get back together with Ramsey, and wouldn't it be just like Harper to ruin that too? Harper gave Ramsey a hug. The Vineyard is only 11 miles away, you know. You're welcome anytime.
I'll come in the fall, Ramsey said. How about that?
Great, Harper said.
She figured he was just being polite. People on the Vineyard always vow to do things in the fall, when the hectic pace of summer is over, but then the fall becomes busier than anyone could have predicted, and the holidays loom on the horizon. Harper had offered the Vineyard up to Megan and her husband as well, but she doubted they'd ever come. Those 11 miles might as well be 1,100. The Vineyard might as well be Vegas or Venus. If Ramsey does come in the fall, he will learn that Harper is pregnant. She imagines meeting him at the ferry with her rounded belly.
Surprise!
It had been hardest, of course, to say goodbye to Ainsley. There were so many things Harper wanted to tell her niece. Be a good girl. Be kind to your mother. Be patient with your grandmother. Don't drink until your 21st birthday. Then you and I will drink together. Good champagne. Don't smoke ever. Never fall in love. Fall in love with abandon. Things will make sense when you're older. Things will never make sense. Life isn't fair. Make good decisions. Don't beat yourself up when you make bad decisions. Value yourself the way I value you. Travel. Listen. Question. Wear sunscreen. Use birth control. Don't buy tomatoes out of season. I will miss you. You are a wonderful, talented child, Ainsley, and I'm only ever a boat ride away. And then, last but not least, scissors cut paper. Rock smashes scissors. Paper covers rock. Ainsley said,
next summer, can I come live with you on the Vineyard and be your nanny?
Nanny? Harper hadn't yet thought of herself as a person who would need a nanny. But for Ainsley's sake, she smiled and said without hesitation, absolutely. She leaves Tabitha at Billy's house to take a shower and pack, and she drops Fish and her belongings off at the duplex. Fish collapses on his Orvis bed and closes his blue eyes, and Harper is glad. She feared he would want to go with her when she left, but she needs to do this alone.
I'll be back in a little while, bud, she says.
Fish doesn't even lift his head. Sheep crossing. She knows the road, although as a delivery person, she has overshot it half a dozen times at least. It's nothing more than a slender dirt and sand path, really, with a tiny wooden sign half hidden by overgrown brush. Harper turns onto the road, blood rushing in her ears,
anxiety coursing through her in a way that can't be good for the baby.
"We're going to meet your father," she thinks.
She pulls into the first driveway on the left, as Tabitha said to do, and there is the Lexus and there is Reed's bike. Harper is sweating now, and her breathing is shallow. Her nerves are in control. She turns off the car and sits, then thinks, well, this is it. She walks up to the door and knocks.
Hello?
Harper turns at the voice. A man, not Reed, is strolling across the lawn holding a bottle of scotch. The man has a handlebar mustache waxed into curlicues, and despite the heat, Harper shivers. She can handle just about any variation on a man's appearance. After all, for 3 years she lived with Rooster's coxcomb, and before that she lived with Joey Bowen's mullet. But she cannot tolerate a handlebar mustache. The man offers his hand, and Harper shakes it expediently.
"I'm Dick Davenport, the neighbor," he says. "Would you be looking for Dr. Zimmer?"
Dick Davenport? She thinks. The name fits him perfectly. He's half barbershop quartet, half 1970s porn star.
"I would be," she says, wishing she had paid attention at Windsor when they were learning about tense in English class.
Would be is the conditional? Past conditional?
"He's not home," Dick says. "I took him to the ferry around lunchtime. I was just stopping by to drop off this Lefroig as a thank you. Reed collected my newspapers while I was home in Atlanta."
"Oh," Harper says. Dick looks like he wants to hand her the scotch. "You took him to the ferry? Was he going somewhere?"
"Yes," Dick says.
He gives Harper a conspicuous once-over.
"You're very, very pretty. You aren't single by any chance, are you? I would love to take you to dinner. How about tonight? I happen to know the new reservationist at the Covington."
Harper is completely blindsided. The neighbor of the house where Reed is hiding, or was hiding, as he is apparently left on the ferry for parts unknown, is asking her on a date.
"Thank you, but I can't. I'm having dinner with my sister tonight."
"I'll take you both out," Dick says. "Is she as pretty as you?"
"Maybe another time," Harper says.
She takes a few steps backwards until she is an arm's length away from the Bronco, and she watches as Dick sets the scotch inside the screen door. She slips into the driver's seat, doesn't bother with the seatbelt. She can't get out of there fast enough. Dick waves. Harper throws the car in reverse. When she gets back to Billy's house, Tabitha is sitting on one of the brand new kitchen stools, drinking a glass of champagne. The bottle is on the counter next to her, and Harper blinks, thinking she's seeing things. It's Bielcott Salmon Rosé, the same champagne that Harper brought to Nantucket 14 years earlier, the champagne they drank together on the end of the dock while skimming their feet against the water's surface. Does Tabitha realize this? Did she choose this champagne on purpose? She must have. Very little escapes her sister. So is this a sign, then? Tabitha has forgiven Harper? She's ready to move on? For real? Harper is unconvinced.
"Get a glass from the cabinet," Tabitha says. "I'll pour you a teensy bit."
"Did you find Franklin?" Harper asks.
"Called him. Went straight to voicemail. Went to his house. His truck is there, but he's not home. I peeked in the windows."
"Reed is gone, too," Harper says. "His neighbor said he drove him to the ferry, but didn't say where he was going."
"When I saw your car pull in, I figured something like that," Tabitha says.
Harper pulls a champagne flute from the new glass front cabinets. The kitchen bears no resemblance to the unsanitary stinkhole it used to be. Harper sees that Tabitha bought new stemware from Tiffany. The champagne flute still has the blue circle sticker on the base. "These seem pretty fancy," Harper says. "Are we going to make any profit after all this work?"
"Huge profit," Tabitha says. "The glasses are for show. We'll take them with us when we sell."
Now that the house is such a showpiece, Harper doesn't want to sell. She would like to live here herself in Billy's new old house. But that isn't the deal, and she can't argue with the phrase, huge profit. Tabitha lifts the bottle and pours a token amount of champagne into Harper's flute. She raises her own glass. There's a man still left in this house, she says.
There is? Harper says.
Is Tad still here?
No,
Tabitha says. Billy. His ashes are on the mantle. What do you say we give him a proper scattering?
Billy, Harper thinks.
She closes her eyes and sees her father in the hospital bed. How many hours did she spend playing spades with him on the little formica table attached to his bed? Harper remembers all the way back to the phone calls that used to come for her father in the middle of the night when they lived on Pinckney Street. Apparently, there were emergencies in the city of Boston that only Billy Frost could fix. Half the rooms at the Park Plaza had lost power. The walk-in fridge was on the fritz at Loch Ober. There had been an electrical fire in the boiler room of the public library. Billy was the electrician of choice among Boston's hoi polloi in those days. His career wasn't as glamorous as Eleanor's, but he had held his own. He was popular with union bosses and local politicians. Nearly everywhere they went, Southie, Chinatown, Fenway, Billy bumped into someone who owed him a drink. When Eleanor asked him for a divorce, he had been more resigned than angry, as if he'd figured that day would come sooner or later. And in many ways, most ways even, he had been happier in his life on the vineyard. Harper can see him on the beach at Cape Pogue, patiently pulling the hooks from the mouths of every fish they caught, his motions competent and assured. Billy was a man who always knew what he was doing. She pictures him in his usual seat at the lookout, turning to see her walk in, grinning, signaling the bartender, sop, and calling out, "A beer and a dozen Malpecs for my old lady, please." Harper tries to imagine Billy as a young man, setting eyes on Eleanor Roxy for the first time. They met at the country club in Brookline at a Christmas party Eleanor's parents threw every year. Billy had come to the party as the date of Eleanor's first cousin, Rhonda Fiorello, but Eleanor didn't care for Rhonda and had no qualms about stealing her date away. Eleanor was 21, a senior at Pine Manor, and Billy, an older man at 23, had done 2 years at UMass Boston in electrical engineering before switching to trade school. Harper had seen pictures of her parents in their beautiful youth, and she marvels at the attraction they felt for each other in 1967 had endured 50 years. If Eleanor was telling the truth about Billy sneaking over to her house in the middle of the night. Harper has been so caught up in her own drama that she hasn't been able to mourn Billy's passing. She hadn't planned on scattering Billy's ashes at all, mostly because she couldn't bear to do it alone. But now that Tabitha is here, the decision seems appropriate. "Let's do it," Harper says. She and Tabitha touch glasses and drink. Harper drives, because the vineyard is still technically her island, and Billy was her parent.
"You knew him better than I did," Tabitha says, "and I never knew him here. Where would he want his ashes to be scattered?"
Harper has been wondering the exact same thing. She decides that part of Billy should rejoin the land, and part of him should rejoin the water surrounding it. Part of him should stay with Harper, and part of him should go to Nantucket with Tabitha. It's hard to know how to feel about the ashes. They aren't Billy, but they aren't nothing either. "We'll scatter a quarter at the harbor in Oak Bluffs and a quarter at Farm Neck," Harper says.
"The golf club?" Tabitha asks.
Harper nods. If there's one thing Harper is sure of, it's that Billy would want to have his remains fertilizing the tea at the third hole.
"I never wanted to go back there again," Tabitha says.
"Oh, well," Harper says. Farm Neck has closed for the day, and Harper worries that they will be denied access to the course. She asks at the front desk for Kendall, who appears within seconds looking as dapper as ever, tie, matching pocket square,
shiny buckled shoes. He smiles when he sees the twins, which Harper supposes is nothing short of a miracle, seeing as how Harper invited disgrace right in the front door of this private club.
"Harper," he says, "and Tabitha."
He's excited to see Tabitha, Harper realizes, and she feels the ancient hurt of people always preferring her sister. But in this instance, she knows she should be grateful.
"We have a favor to ask," Harper says.
"Wow," Tabitha says as they stand at the tee of the third hole.
"Look at that view."
Harper nods. The third hole has the finest vista, possibly, on the entire island, across Sengi Pond over the beach with a tip of Chappie visible in the distance. If there is a heaven and Billy has anything to say about it, Harper thinks, it probably looks something like this. They proceed to the harbor in Oak Bluffs next. Harper finds a parking spot right near the ferry dock, a miracle in itself, and now Tabitha carries the urn. There are tourists everywhere, and Harper adjusts her expectations for this venture. It's not going to be a peaceful, profound moment. They should each toss a handful and try not to attract anyone's notice. There are families shopping and eating ice cream, trying to enjoy summer. Nobody wants to be witness to an ersatz funeral. Harper leads Tabitha down the dock but stops dead in her tracks. There is a motor yacht as white and sculptured as a wedding cake right in front of them. And on the back of the yacht, all dressed up, is Drew Truman amid a gaggle of elegant-looking older black women.
His mother, Harper thinks, and the aunties.
"What's wrong?" Tabitha says. She follows Harper's gaze. "Do you know those ladies? Girlfriends of Billy's? Think they want to join us?"
"No, keep walking,"
Harper says, without opening her mouth.
"Why?" Tabitha says. "Look, one of those women is wearing mother's dress."
Harper turns. One of the aunties, or maybe it's Yvonne, because she's the one who is standing closest to Drew, is wearing the Roxy in ivory. The dress accentuates Yvonne's waist but still presents a classic silhouette. Harper feels an unexpected surge of pride. Her mother designed something that will last generations beyond her death. How many people can say that? As they head down the dock, Harper with her head down, there's a sharp whistle, and involuntarily Harper looks up. Drew is waving at her, and Polly Childs, the realtor, has suddenly materialized at Drew's side. Polly drapes an arm over Drew's shoulder and gives Harper a finger wave.
"Hey, Harper," Drew says. "Hello, Tabitha."
"Do I know that guy?" Tabitha asks.
"You met him at Billy's reception," Harper says. "He's the policeman I was sort of dating."
"Looks like he's sort of dating someone else now," Tabitha says.
"Sorry, sis." She grabs Harper's hand, and they walk purposefully down the dock. Tabitha removes the top from the urn, and they reach in for a handful of their father's remains.
"Ready?" Tabitha says. "One, two, three."
Together, they throw the ashes into the air. The powder sparkles like mica.
"We love you, Daddy," Harper says.
If the baby is a boy, she decides then, she will name him William.
"If the baby is a boy, you should name him William," Tabitha says.
Harper whips her head around to look at her sister.
"You can read my mind?" she nearly asks. "Is this a talent you've had all along?"
But she notices that there are tears standing in Tabitha's eyes. Poor pony. Harper throws an arm around Tabitha's shoulders. She marvels at how everything in the world is bearable now, with her sister at her side. Martha's Vineyard. The most underrated force at work in the universe is that of coincidence. And yet, who among us hasn't been at its mercy? Sadie Zimmer has left the house only when necessary since Reed moved out. She closed the pie shop, has turned down invitations to barbecues and cocktail parties with friends, and has repeatedly said no to joining the Excellent Point book group, even though her mother has been relentless in trying to get Sadie to think about something other than her pathetic life circumstances.
That's the wonderful thing about books, Lydia said. You get to read about other people's trials and tribulations. Spend an afternoon with Kafka, and you'll be counting your blessings you didn't wake up to find yourself turned into a cockroach.
Sadie doesn't want to read Kafka. She doesn't even want to read Nicholas Sparks or Maria Semple. Sadie wants to wallow in self-pity. It feels good. Poring over Reed's cell phone bills and detailing the number of calls he made to Harper and how long those calls lasted. Stalking Harper on Facebook, although admittedly the offerings there are sparse. Harper hasn't posted anything since she put up a photo of her and her father landing a 40-inch striped bass in 2014 with the caption, "Size matters, 40 inches." In that photo, Harper is squinting under the brim of a farm neck golf club visor. She's wearing white cutoff shorts and a man's fishing shirt turned back at the cuffs. Is she pretty? Sadie supposes so, but she has a reputation for trouble. Joey Bowen and all that. And as a doctor, Reed has professional and personal standards to uphold. If he started up with Harper Frost, he must have been desperate. He was desperate, Sadie knows, because she froze him out as a husband and as a man. What did she expect? That he was going to live out his adult life without sex? Sadie had had no intention of letting him back into their marital bed. She had been the one who fantasized about leaving Reed. She had an agonizing crush on Tad Morrissey, but she would never have had the courage to act on it, out of fear of rejection and, she supposed, because she worried what her parents would think and how the rest of the island would talk about her. They are talking about her now, but at least she's cast as the sympathetic victim. Sadie scrutinizes the photo on Facebook a little while longer. She shifts her focus from Harper to Billy. Sadie had always liked Billy Frost. He had come over to replace some fixtures at the shop way back when. But thinking about this leads to thinking about Harper coming into the store to buy her father a lobster pot pie. Harper had come into the store. Had she been sleeping with Reed then? Yes, she had. By his own account, their affair had started in October, and Harper had come into the store in March or April. She had been screwing Sadie's husband for 6 months, but she had seen nothing wrong with stopping in to get Billy a pie. Probably she had been checking Sadie out. And what, Sadie wonders, had she thought? But then one day Sadie wakes up, and she doesn't feel wretched. She actually feels pretty good. It's a beautiful day. She can walk right across the street to Grange Hall, where they hold the farmer's market. She finds herself craving egg rolls from Ken's. And while she's at it, she'll grab some gladiolus, a bottle of Nikki's olive oil, and some lemon ginger honey from the Martha's Vineyard Honey Company. The first person Sadie bumps into inside the Ag Hall is Dorrit Prescott, Patty Prescott's mother. Dorrit's face lights up in direct proportion to Sadie's spirits sinking. It's not that Sadie doesn't like Dorrit. Dorrit is a wonderful person. It's just that since Patty's death, however many years ago it was, Dorrit has become intense. She doesn't believe in small talk. She likes to get heavy, deep, and real, even while standing in front of the jelly table at the farmer's market.
Sadie! Dorrit cries.
Hi, Dorrit, Sadie says. She grabs a jar of hot pepper jelly from the table. She suddenly finds herself ravenous after not having had an appetite for weeks. The delicacies of the farmer's market have been within a softball's throw of her house, but she has had no interest in them until today. Now she wants a little of everything. A popover with raspberry butter from Kitchen Porch, a mango lassi from Mermaid Farm, Eidolon cheese from Gray Barn, Vineyard Sunshine granola from Little Rock Farm, rugola from Beth's Bakery. She doesn't have time for a therapy session with Dorrit Prescott. Dorrit grasps Sadie's forearm.
Here it comes, Sadie thinks. She's going to ask about the affair and about Reed leaving. She's going to ask how Sadie is doing.
How's Franklin? Dorrit says. I heard through the grapevine that he was dating someone from Nantucket. Is that true?
Franklin? Sadie isn't prepared for a question about Franklin, although it makes sense that Dorrit would ask, since Patty was Franklin's girlfriend, and he hasn't dated anyone seriously since Patty killed herself. Sadie can't believe that the one person he does have feelings for is Harper's twin sister. It's the most insidious of ironies, the most nefarious of plot twists.
I hope you tell me it's true, Dorrit says. All Turk and I want is for Franklin to find someone he loves. He's been through so much. He deserves it.
Sadie nods her agreement. Franklin does deserve it. Back when Patty died, Sadie worried that he would never recover. And then plenty of times in the intervening years, Sadie wondered if he would ever fall in love again.
I'm not sure what's going on with Franklin's love life, Sadie says.
This is a bold-faced lie. Sadie does know what's going on with Franklin's love life. Nothing. Sadie told Franklin he had to choose between her and Tabitha, and he dutifully chose her, his sister, his family, because that is the kind of solid, loyal person he is.
I am a bitter, miserable ogress, Sadie thinks. Franklin deserves love just like anybody else, more than anybody else. It was good seeing you, Dorrit, Sadie says. I'm going to get some rugula.
You need it, Dorrit says. You're too thin. Sadie gets the rugula and a fresh squeezed OJ from Good Tastes. Then she steps into the sun. She'll sit outside and enjoy this feast. Then she'll go back in for a popover and a big box of sea salt caramels from Enchanted Chocolates to take home. Why not? She is too thin. At that instant, she sees Tad Morrissey sitting in the grass by himself with what she recognizes as a nitro cold brew from Chilmark Coffee. He waves her over. Come sit with me, he says. Later, after Sadie puts a dozen gladiolas in water and takes a shower, she's meeting Tad for pizza that night, she sends Franklin a text. It says, Go be with Tabitha. You have my blessing. Reed Zimmer sees Franklin Phelps standing in line at the snack bar on the Inter-Island Ferry, and he wonders if Sadie has sent Franklin to follow him. Why else, honestly? For what other possible reason would his brother-in-law, Franklin Phelps, be heading to Nantucket? Reed waits until Franklin is engaged with the girl behind the counter. Then he hurries up the stairs and finds a seat in the sun on the upper deck. He leans his head back against the molded plastic chair and promptly falls asleep. Franklin has brought nothing with him for his trip to Nantucket except his wallet and his guitar. The wallet provides money with which to buy two beers. He'll have no more than three, he decides. Traveling by ferry to the other island to track down the woman you love is only a grand romantic gesture if you're clear of eye and pure of heart. The guitar provides Franklin with friends. No sooner has he sat down than he has a trio of teenage girls asking if he knows the song Here by Alessia Cara. No, he says. But I do know Sunshine by Jonathan Edwards.
Never heard of it, says a girl with pink braces. Do you know any Meghan Trainor?
Negative, Franklin says. I know Free Bird by Lynyrd Skynyrd.
How about Justin Bieber? A girl with a pierced eyebrow asks. Love Yourself?
Nope, Franklin says proudly. They compromise on Killing Me Softly. Franklin knows the Roberta Flack version, and the girls know the Fugees version, and it's fun. The girls are good singers. From there, requests start rolling in. Franklin plays some James Taylor, some Bob Dylan, some Cat Stevens. Soon, everyone in his section of the boat is singing, and some guy even offers him a $10 tip. Franklin smiles as he waves the money away. He needs help, all right, but not that kind.
Reed wakes up to a round of applause coming from inside the boat. He blinks his eyes and sits up straight as Nantucket comes into focus. Lighthouse, jetty, big houses along the harbor. It's not so different from the vineyard, he thinks. He should be fine. When they dock, he hangs back to let everyone else get off first. If Franklin hangs back as well, then Reed will know he's only there to keep tabs on him. And how will Reed explain this trip? It's folly, really. He received a visit from Harper's twin sister, Tabitha, which almost ended disastrously. But Tabitha admitted her identity in the nick of time and ran from the house. Reed thought that if Tabitha is on the vineyard, then Harper might be on Nantucket with their mother. Reed had scoured the woods behind Aunt Dot's house for his phone. He found it, but it was cold and dead, ruined by moisture. He rode his bike to the library to use a computer and found one Frost listed in the white pages on Nantucket, an Eleanor Roxy Frost. Is that Harper's mother's name? Yes, he thinks so. Franklin is lucky enough to get a taxi right away. It's actually offered to him by the parents of one of the teeny boppers in his audience. It's only when Franklin gets into the taxi that he realizes he has no idea where he's going. He checks his phone and sees he has a missed call from Tabitha. It must have come in while he was playing. He nearly calls her back, but then he thinks how much better it will be if he just shows up to surprise her. He leans over the seat. The cab driver is a middle-aged guy wearing a Free Brady t-shirt. "Do you by any chance know where the Frosts live?" Franklin asks. The driver nods. "Sure do." Nantucket. Eleanor and Flossie are enjoying their last happy hour together, with Ainsley for company. Eleanor sent Philippa to 167 to get the bluefish pate, the guacamole, and 2 pounds of shrimp cocktail. Eleanor wants to send Flossie off in style. They're ordering in from the lobster trap tonight, surf and turf. Eleanor raises a glass. "Flossie, I don't know what I ever would have done without you." Flossie clinks her glass against Eleanor's. "Probably inspired Philippa to murder you in your sleep." The doorbell rings. Eleanor looks at Ainsley. "Maybe it's your mother back already. Go see, please, darling." Ainsley rises, and Flossie says, "I can't believe you make your own daughters ring the bell. Honestly, Ellie, you need to loosen up." Eleanor disagrees. She's about to inform Flossie that she is loose enough as it is, thank you very much, when Ainsley walks onto the porch escorting a very handsome gentleman holding a guitar. He bows in front of Eleanor as though she's a queen. Eleanor loves this man already. But who is he? And why the guitar? Eleanor fears this is a singing telegram or a male stripper, something orchestrated by Flossie on her last day in order to loosen Eleanor up. "I'm Franklin Phelps," the gentleman says. "I've come in search of Tabitha." "Tabitha," Eleanor says. "Here is the suitor, then. The brother of the woman married to Billy's doctor." Eleanor remembers herself and holds out her hand. "Franklin, I'm Eleanor Roxy Frost, Tabitha's mother." "And I'm Flossie," Flossie says, offering her hand. She wants right in on the action, Eleanor sees. Typical Flossie. She can't leave a good-looking male alone. "I'm Tabitha's aunt." "Nice to meet you both," Franklin says. "I told him Mom's not here," Ainsley says. "She's on the vineyard." "Comedy of errors," Franklin says. "I just came from the vineyard." "She'll be right back," Eleanor says. "By morning, anyway. You might as well sit tight right here. I'll have Philippa make up the guest room." "I couldn't impose," Franklin says. "I want you to impose," Eleanor says. "Me too," Flossie says. Eleanor turns to Flossie, trying not to let her impatience with her flirtatious younger sister show. "Can we offer Franklin a drink, Flossie?" "We can," Flossie says. "What's your poison, Franklin?" "A beer would be wonderful," Franklin says.
Or a whiskey, if you don't have beer.
Whiskey it is, Eleanor says.
She waves Flossie away to fetch the drink.
Please sit, Franklin, and then tell us what it is you do for a living. Are you a professional musician?
I play the guitar for fun, Franklin says. He settles in the armchair opposite Eleanor and places the guitar case at his feet. By trade, I'm a carpenter. I have my own construction business. I'm helping Tabitha and Harper renovate Billy's house.
Eleanor claps her hands.
Well, when you're finished with that, you can renovate my house, she says. She casts her eyes around. What could use a spruce up? Surely there must be something.
Flossie returns with Franklin's drink. The house is perfect as it is, Ellie, Flossie says. She winks at Franklin. That's just Eleanor's way of saying she likes you. Eleanor is embarrassed by this statement, although she does indeed like this gentleman. He's adorable. Eleanor didn't think she would ever like anyone as much as she liked Ramsay Stryker, but she's pleased to see she was wrong about that. The doorbell rings again. Grand Central Terminal, Flossie mutters. Ainsley stands up.
Maybe that's Mom.
But the person Ainsley brings into the glassed-in porch next is another gentleman caller. This one is bespectacled and a bit more buttoned up. Khaki pants, custom-tailored shirt. Eleanor knows bespoke when she sees it, and suede Gucci loafers. Ainsley looks like she's popped a whole habanero pepper unwittingly into her mouth. She's pink, and her eyes are bulging. Cute Franklin gets to his feet. Reed? The new caller turns to Eleanor.
Hello, ma'am. I'm Dr. Reed Zimmer. I'm looking for Harper.
Harper? Eleanor says. She gasps.
Are you the father, then?
Father, Franklin says. The doctor blanches.
Father?
He says.
The father, Flossie says in clarification, of Harper's baby. She's pregnant, you know.
It's clear from the misty look that comes over the doctor's face that he doesn't know. Leave it to Flossie to let the cat out of the bag, Eleanor thinks. The moment of everyone's speechless shock gives Eleanor a chance to compare and contrast the two gentlemen before her. Franklin, with his darling must hair and his flip-flops, seems like he would be more Harper's type. And this Dr. Zimmer, with his glasses and his bespoke shirt, seems like he would be more Tabitha's type. But apparently, it's the other way around. There is nothing more mysterious, confounding, and unknowable, Eleanor thinks, than the desires of the human heart.
Flossie, she says, can't you see the man needs a drink?
To the doctor, Eleanor says, please sit down and try the bluefish pâté. It's wonderful. Epilogue. Fish. His is a life of the senses, but over the course of his 12 and a half years, or 87 and a half years, depending on who's counting, he has also developed other intelligences. He has become savvy with places, both new and familiar, and with the circadian rhythms of day, night, and season. But mostly, he has become adept at reading human emotion. If he were ever granted the ability to speak, he would spend half his time asking questions. Why wear clothes? Why use utensils? Why litter? And the other half explaining people to themselves. When the weather cools down and the days grow shorter, Harper's shape starts to change. Then her scent starts to change. Harper packs up their things again, and Fish wonders if they're going back to the other island for good. But instead, they take the barge to Chappie. Harper moves them into a cottage that smells strongly of the surfer. Fish races around the house looking for the surfer, but finds nothing except a sock under the bed. He brings the sock to Harper, and she lets out a soft cry. The surfer is replaced by the doctor. The doctor is around a little bit at first, then more often, then all the time. He becomes the one who lets Fish out in the morning and before bed. Harper, however, still takes Fish for long walks,
now on East Beach. Fish loves East Beach. It's replete with dead crabs and seaweed, snails, mermaids' purses, scraps of picnic. As Harper walks him, she says things like, "What am I doing, Fish? What am I doing? I don't know anything about being a mother." If Fish could talk, he would tell Harper she's wrong. She has been the kindest, most steadfast mother he could have dreamed of. Sometimes, when Harper, Fish, and the doctor are together lounging on the sofa or watching TV and Harper falls asleep, the doctor will take Fish's head in his hands and stare him straight in the eyes. "I'm telling you, man to man," he says, "I will take care of her. I will take care of her and you, and I will take care of that baby." Fish supposes he should register surprise at the news of a baby, but his is a life of the senses, so he has already figured out there is a baby coming. He's already felt a second heartbeat thrumming in his ear as he lays his head on Harper's belly. And then, only a day or two ago, he felt a kick. Instead of being affronted, Fish was flattered. The baby was reaching out. The baby, he guesses, will be his friend, possibly the most excellent friend he has ever known. A day arrives that seems important. There are balloons, presents, a cake delivered from someone named the Tiny Baker, who is, in fact, tiny, and who brings a pug named Lucy Bean with her. Lucy Bean barks at Fish and bares her teeth as Tiny Baker hands over the cake. Fish merely shakes his head. Pugs are difficult to take seriously. It's not baby day, he doesn't think. He soon learns it's Harper's birthday, her 40th birthday. She and the doctor and Fish and Edie, the surfer's mother, will celebrate, light the candles, sing, eat cake. But there is something Harper must do first. She and Fish drive out to Cape Pogue alone. Fish is confused. Harper has forgotten to bring her fishing pole. "I know this may seem crazy," Harper says, "but I'm going to wish Tabitha a happy birthday. She's standing on the beach at Ram Pasture on Nantucket, and she is going to wish me a happy birthday." Fish stares off into the distance. All he sees is water. "With me on Cape Pogue and Tabitha at Ram Pasture, we are as physically close as we can get while still remaining on our respective islands," Harper says. She touches her protruding midsection. "She and Franklin are coming over on Friday so that we can close on Billy's house, but that isn't our actual birthday. It's imperative we do this today." She checks Billy's watch on her wrist. "I call out to her at 3:12 because that's when Pony was born. Pony will call out to me at 3:14 because that's when I was born." Harper cups her hands around her mouth and shouts, "Happy birthday, Tabitha!" Fish stares off into the distance. Water and more water. People are nuts, he thinks. Even Harper. But then, just about 90 seconds later, Fish cocks his head. It's faint. Possibly he's projecting. But no, it's real. A voice nearly identical to the one he hears every day, but just a little bit different. It's a nuance only a very perceptive dog would notice. "Happy birthday, Harper! Happy, happy birthday!" Fish barks.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of The Identicals. Written by Ellen Hildebrand. Read by Aaron Bennett. Produced by Dennis Kao. Recorded by John Kovarik. Sound editing by Sean Bolter. Mixing and mastering by Jeremy Wesley. Production supervised by Christine M. Farrell. The Identicals is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, an imprint of Grand Central Publishing, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2017 by Ellen Hildebrand. Audio production copyright 2017 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.